who hath understanding, reckon the number of the beast. For it is a human.
Look at this.
Its number is 666.
It is a little.
Arise, dark children, for today is the day of the beast. Yea, the hour is at hand when the plans of the Prince of Darkness shall reach fruition.
Yeah.
Yea, gays shall marry, fetuses shall be aborted, and evolution shall be taught to the children.
Yeah.
People shall have sex for fun.
Yeah.
So dial 231-8187 and lend your voice to our dark chorus
On
the Abe and Joe Show. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Where's my favorite thing? Charcoal train, dude.
Dark brethren.
Oh, yeah. Dark brethren, my butt.
Well, okay.
You know what that's going to do?
What's that?
That's going to create some rumor on the internet that, you know.
They were devil worshippers?
They were devil worshippers.
That's not true.
That's what you're going
to do. All the other rumors are true, but that one's not.
Oh, man. Sick, sick, sick.
Yep.
What? So what? Today is the sixth month.
Six months, six year. Of the second millennium.
Second millennium doesn't count.
I don't know.
666.
Yeah.
Mark of the Beast. But, you know, there's all that revelation is totally misinterpreted by the...
It's just a bunch of hooey.
Hooey.
But it's fun.
It is fun. I always look forward to the horsemen of the apocalypse and all that stuff. Oh, yeah.
Famine, pestilence.
Plague.
Death and war. Yeah.
Things like that.
Yeah.
Those are always there. They always...
What? Good times.
Good times.
Yep.
And brought to you by the United States government these days. Wow.
Yep.
Did I say that?
You did.
Could it be that George W. Bush is the Antichrist?
He's not smart enough to be the Antichrist. Cheney's one of the undead. I think he's really the
Cheney Antichrist. Cheney is actually the bionic man. You know, he has parts made in Satan's workshop.
In Taiwan. Greg Palast was here last night.
He was.
It was fantastic.
You enjoyed that, huh?
I did. I couldn't believe the turnout. You know,
it filled the hall.
It did. I talked to Dave Mazza a couple days previous, and he was worried. You know,
that's the job. The promoter always worries
that the publicity wasn't there.
Yeah. Yeah.
But man, there are people spilling out the door around the block waiting to get in to see.
Alliance did well. I think we get some of that. No, not you and I personally, but Cable gets some of that money.
Yeah, it was.
I asked him, "What's the deal? What's the cut? You know, what's the cut?" He didn't want to tell me, or he didn't know what the cut is.
You asked Palast that?
No.
You asked Mazza?
Palast doesn't know or care. I don't know.
Well, you know, he's selling books.
Palast is the world's greatest self-promoter, too. I really like that. He looks slick.
It was a great gathering. He laid it all out.
You know, I actually thought for a moment there that we could do more. Not only was this great, but we could do more.
Yeah, I thought so, too.
I want to promote the hell out of Medea Benjamin's appearance in town. It's a couple of weeks away, Friday, June 16th, you know, at the St. Francis of Assisi Catholic Church.
Yeah, she's wonderful.
She is really great. Let's try to get her on the air if we can.
Yeah, I think she'd
do that. We're going to do that.
She's a K-Boo kind of person.
Oh, my goodness, something has been handed to me. Oh, whoa, wait, hold it. Hey, Satanists, call your tattoo artist and make an appointment now. That's 666. It's wrong. You're 5 days late.
Uh-oh.
For centuries, people have been intrigued by the number 666, the number of the beast from the book of Revelation in the New Testament. Do you know that the New Testament is an arbitrary collection of Jesus' stuff?
Yep.
That there's much discussion. There's a lot of left-out stuff.
Yeah, there's an account.
Apocrypha, etc.
Yeah, the Apocrypha.
Yeah. Did I say it? Apocrypha?
Apocrypha, yeah.
Not only is it mentioned in the Bible, it has been associated with the Satanism universal price codes, the game of roulette, as the numbers on the wheel add up to 666. Did you know that?
No, I didn't know that.
I didn't either. I don't know that just because it says this, but it's...
The only one I'd believe. Roulette's got to be the devil.
Now, the legendary number is getting a fresh look. As researchers are reexamining evidence, the number may actually be 616. Oh, no.
That's just not as much fun.
Many Bibles have footnotes say the number translated from the original Greek could be 616. Now experts say new photographic evidence of an ancient fragment of papyrus from Revelation indeed indicates the number is 616. What this means is that if you have Berserker tattooed on your forehead, you are probably right. On the other hand, if you have 666 on your brow, you are wrong. This is from WorldMed.com.
Yeah, that was an item on the news earlier, before our show.
I didn't realize that that was possible, that we could all be wrong about something as fundamental as
the book of Revelations.
Yeah, right.
Dude, somebody could have got that one
wrong.
The whole
of the modern Christianity, of the hate Christianity as opposed to the gospel of love that Jesus taught, is based on that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that whole Jesus is back and he's pissed off.
Yeah, right. Hate. Yeah. You know, have you noticed that George Bush, having been back to the wall, incredibly unpopular, turns at long last to a major issue in this time? He is not worried about the fact that most people are poorer than they were before. He is not worried about the incredibly soaring national debt. He is not worried about his disastrous wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. He is not worried that we lost Somalia yesterday,
nope,
by the way. He is not worried that the environment is going to hell. None of these things. He's not worried there's no health care. None of this troubles him. He's concerned that gays might be married, and we need, which he can never get. I know he can never get it through the Congress or through the American people. He wants to make a constitutional amendment to describe what is and what is not marriage.
He's grandstanding. That's what he's doing.
Well, he's not just grandstanding. He's playing to the dim crowd.
That's right. He wants to say marriage will be between a man and a woman until they get divorced.
Could that be in the Constitution? Until they get divorced.
Until they get divorced.
Well, yeah. What about the plural marriage people?
I don't know. Save that for another day.
You know, actually, somebody sent us, and I want to thank them, the Hood River News.
Mm-hmm.
That's a newspaper in Hood River, Oregon. You would never guess. One of the letters to the editor actually says, for those of you who think the Oregon Public Broadcasting is left-wing and really want to hear the real deal, check out KBOO Community Radio each Tuesday morning at 7:30 to 9 for a show called Talk Radio with hosts Abe Proctor and Joe Uris.
Oh, cool.
This is a show where logical truth is spoken. That's not true. Nothing spoon-fed or sugar-coated like commercial radio or TV. That is true.
We sugar-coat it sometimes.
Oh, well. It is so refreshing to actually hear people talking and calling in about politics, torture, worldviews, you name it, and backing their talk with facts. KBOO is 90.7 FM. Yeah, that's where you are. And in the Gorge, it's 91.7 FM in Hood River. Check it out.
We have minions in the Gorge.
We have minions.
I love it.
Minions. Now, minion in the Jewish faith is 10 people. You get them together to pray, it's more powerful.
Hey, that's about right. I bet we have about 10 people in the Gorge.
Stephen Curley, Hood River, wrote that. I have so many items, and I am so overwhelmed by... No, I can't help but... I just think it's really important that we're going to have a George Bush pushing a constitutional amendment on on gay marriage.
He's really a small, pathetic man, isn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's everything he does now smacks of desperation, it seems.
Well, what's even more pathetic is the fact that we now have demonstrated, to my satisfaction, the degree to which these people have finagled and phonied up the electoral process. And in the process of getting these guys in and getting this powerful minority of rich people in charge. And by the way, it's not all the rich people. It's an interesting, it's a subset of the rich. Actually,
I'd have to say it's most of the rich.
I'm not sure, because, you know, a lot of wealthy people are not really, they don't have anything against the estate tax, for example. They didn't really want the tax burden shifted in the way it was. Then, and some, a lot of them do, but it's not that, you know, because they have tax avoidance without that.
That's true.
That's why they have all those lawyers and stuff.
Yeah, they'd rather pay more in lawyers fees than they do in taxes on principal, which is something.
Now, of course, there is a measure on our ballot in Oregon that would require companies that are utilities, I think it's just utilities, to actually, no, I think, is it all corporations?
I think that, really, the alternative, the corporate minimum tax?
Yeah,
corporate minimum. The 10
minimum.
Bucks you got to pay if you don't,
yeah,
they
would require them to actually report.
Wrangle your way out of everything?
Yeah, actually report their earnings and stuff. Okay.
231-8187 is the number to call. I'd like to get a lot of callers in today. I want to hear your impressions of Greg Palast's speech last night, if you happen to have been there.
Or done that?
Huh?
Or done that.
It was really cool, man. It was really cool.
I thought he was good. I thought he was good. And I actually came round to his position on the shutting down the oil rather than opening up the oil thing. But
yeah,
it doesn't
the blood for petrodollars,
yeah,
not necessarily the blood for oil.
But it doesn't, But it doesn't contradict my fundamental idea, which is that we want bases permanently in Iraq, and that we, the U.S. government, not we, the U.S. government wants bases, and that, of course, it wants control of that oil.
Yeah, you're right. And he said as much, too. He said part of what the House of Saud gets in return for their petrodollars is, you know, the 101st Airborne, permanently stationed in the region.
I have a piece here. I'm not going to get into this today, but there's Cheney apparently is trying to encourage a new Cold War with the Russians. And the fight there, of course, is over the oil from Azerbaijan and this pipeline.
The Caspian Basin.
Caspian Basin, right, and which has been poorly managed by the Russians, it has to be said. It's gooey. And anyway, they're going to have this oil pipeline thing expanded to eventually go to Turkey, through Turkey. And this is going to be a big thing coming up.
Well, it's eventually going to reach Turkey.
Well,
its terminus will be Turkey.
Terminus will be Turkey, but it'll go through Turkey. Turkey's a big country.
It is. And interestingly, before September 11th, a delegation of American diplomats met with the Taliban government in Afghanistan because we wanted to run that self-same pipeline through Afghanistan, and they were opposed. And we told them that, that you need to let us build this pipeline, and if you do, we'll give you a carpet of gold. If not, a carpet of bombs.
Carpet of gold? You made that up.
No, I'm not making this up.
Really?
There's a threat of violence against the Taliban regime.
No, I'm just trying to imagine weaving gold. It's so
September
fragile.
The 11th.
Anyway, I think that people need to understand the history of Afghanistan a little bit, not a lot. You know, it once was predominantly Buddhist.
Mm-hmm. You know, there are these incredible statues.
Yeah, they got blown up by the Taliban. Awful Taliban. Yeah. But you know, interestingly enough, if you read Kim, Rudyard Kipling's kind of book about the young boy. The, of course, orphaned European boy who was a street urchin in India. You discover in that book the Great Game. Well, the Great Game was the struggle between Great Britain and Russia, not the Soviet Union, Russia, over control of the path from Russia down through Afghanistan and what was then part of the British Empire to the ocean.
Khyber Pass, yeah.
All that. So, you know, this is a long time stuff. We got a lot of callers. I don't know their names.
Let's start taking them.
Oh, it's Jeff.
Jeff, good morning.
Hey, guys.
Hey.
Joe, Abe, Jesus is coming. Look busy.
Yeah. Jesus is coming. Look busy?
the hoo-ha, and I spell that H-O-O-H-A-W, uh-huh. In honor of Hawthorne Boulevard, all the hoo-ha uh-huh. on Hawthorne.
Uh-huh.
Is about all this, the hoo-ha about all this nonsense about the revelation is beyond insane. Remember, St. John, I guess it was, who wrote it, was on drugs in a cave in delirium.
Yeah, see, that's what it reads like, doesn't it?
St. John,
well, not
the
only
divine.
Does it read like that,
but he's St. John the Divine. St. John the Divine.
Oh, of course, yes. I forgot that part.
Divine.
But what we're doing now is we're actually making it policy in this country and dividing the whole world along these lines of whose God are we going to cart in. Whenever there's an emergency, we bring our little red wagon with our little God in it. We cart it into the scene and go, ooh. Anyway, that's what I had to say.
Well,
thanks.
The show
is great.
Hey, thanks a lot, man. You know, I was thinking Bush actually believes this stuff.
Yeah, that's really the big white elephant in the room with regard to his foreign policy.
Yeah, and I think he's, you know, I always am trying to figure out George W. Bush. Is he intelligent? Is he stupid? I think the latter rather than the former. He's manipulated by these people who saw their opportunity with this guy. He's pushing this thing. They find it very useful because it gives them this rock-solid base of reactionary ignorant people, you know?
Yep.
And it's just it's a disaster, Mark.
It is. And he's a dry drunk, and I think that informs this.
Dry drunks are often very rigid in their thinking. But I know several dry drunks and ex-junkies and so on who are actually okay people. So I don't want to diss that whole scene.
But in a nutshell, Bush is an end times believer. He's what they call a Christian Zionist. Christian Zionists are a subset of Christians who are very much in favor of the state of Israel because they believe one of the preconditions for the return of Jesus is that the Jews control the Holy Land once again.
Yeah, and those Jews that don't, the part that Israeli people, Zionists generally don't want to deal with in this context, is the fact that they also believe that any Jews that don't convert at the point of this event,
the rapture,
Yeah, they're going to hell.
Yep. Well, let's go back to the phones.
Yeah.
Mindy?
Lindy.
Good morning, Lindy.
Zero.
Hello. Hi. You're on the air? Oh, we lost Lindy. Ani. Hey there. Hello.
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 You're with us.
Oh, I'm with you. Okay, wonderful, wonderful. Thank you. Anyway, you were talking about the bases in Iraq.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
We must never forget the new city that is being built there that will be called the American Embassy.
Oh, right. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I think that's very important to kind of keep in front of the people because that tells us a whole bunch. Will they call that Bullshit City? I never can remember, is that a long eye or a short eye? But anyway, I just wanted to mention that. And thank you, guys. You're just absolutely wonderful.
Well, thanks
wonderful.
A lot.
And we're happy to have you at least once a week or more if possible.
Well, we really appreciate it.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
She's right.
Do you think it's really creepy that on 666 day, everyone's praising us?
No, it's all part of the plan.
Yeah!
Yeah, there was a... She's,
boy, if we're wrong, we're really in trouble, aren't we?
It's true. She's right to mention those bases. That's another thing. Yeah. That's another white elephant that's not talked about. 14 permanent bases and counting in Iraq.
Plus this huge city that we're building. The biggest project.
What, 100-acre-plus
complex? Yeah, and it's got its own water supply. It's got its own electrical supply. Now, the Iraqi people don't have their own water supplies or their own electricity.
In another era, they might call such a building a colonial palace.
Well, they could. They could very well call it, you know, like the Red Fort at Accra or, you know, things like that.
Right.
Well, let me just tell you, we're not a colonial power.
No.
And we have no interest in doing anything in Iraq except bringing them democracy, which apparently means that everybody's at each other's throat.
Right.
We sure fixed that country up good.
We sure did. We don't have to be a colonial power anymore. We can be a transnational corporate power.
Now, what... Yeah, that's that. But what happens now in American public opinion when, beyond Abu Ghraib, when we begin to discover that routinely, and I'm asserting something that I'm pretty sure is true, routinely American troops, totally freaked out in their situation, in urban guerrilla warfare circumstances, are killing civilians. What does that do to the American? Do the American people just go, oh, never mind, I don't care, I don't, you know, or do they get upset?
Well, I think. The devil is in the details, if you'll forgive the phrase. Only if the American people learn about it, and only if they believe it to be true.
Front page of the Oregonian today.
Yeah, that's true, but the official military inquiry found that they did nothing wrong.
In one case,
yeah.
Which was not true, by the way. That's the one that Amy Goodman blew the whistle on.
That's right.
This is the one, in order for it to be true, somehow all the people in this bombed building, which we did bomb, they acknowledge, went to one room against one wall, and stood there, and the bomb went off and somehow put bullets in them.
Somehow. Yeah, because bombs full of bullets, I guess.
Bomb full of bullets. Well, it's possible.
Yeah. You have to wonder how often it's going on. And also, you know, it seems particularly cruel and sadistic and gruesome when these murders are carried out by service people. But really, I think they're morally equivalent to, a bomb going off in a residential neighborhood. What's the difference, really?
Well... There's a lot of differences. I worry for the hearts and minds of the Americans who are doing this.
I'm not
dismissing the horror and the awfulness of what happens to the people of Iraq. I don't mean that at all. But I think that what this does to the general morality and understanding of humanity, of our troops and so on, and of these individuals is horrendous. You're going to have a lot of people coming home who are going to be all messed up.
Oh, there's already people coming home who are all messed up.
And I don't mean just the usual all messed up, because war messes up anyone who gets into it pretty much. But I mean especially awful in this case.
No, and they can count on very little support from
this
administration
and that's the other thing.
Once they're back.
All right, well, we talked about that, I think it was last week. We talked about the fact that this government, this Bush regime, is cutting down on the care, both psychological and physical, of the veterans of this war. And services and money for support and housing and everything.
Right, because money's tight. But Paris Hilton needs a tax break.
Good point.
Yeah, that's important.
Why did you bring up Paris Hilton?
Well, because the state tax is being debated today, this week in Congress.
I am all in favor of. I'm against the death tax. This is the stupid. How can the American people be befuddled and befooled?
Well, they're pretty well distracted.
Yeah, they are.
Yeah.
My biggest fear, of course, is that gay people will get married.
Yeah, then everything will go to hell.
Yeah,
oh my God.
Oh, that would be so awful. And like, it really doesn't matter. But you know,
except see, this is a tricky issue because you know, clearly it's being thrown up there as a red herring, a straw man.
Red herring, straw man.
Yeah, something to distract from the really, truly pressing issues. But at the same time, the idea that full equality is being denied a subset of our citizenry is irksome to me.
Yes,
really irksome to me.
Yes, to me also. I have some investment in
this
issue.
It makes me flat out mad.
Pisses me off.
Yeah, it pisses me off. So that makes.
I think gay people should be able to get married and get divorced at the same rate as the rest of us.
Agreed. Yes. Gay marriages should be allowed to fail just as often as straight marriages.
And I'm sure they would.
So, you know, when I say that this is being thrown up as a distraction, as a straw man, this is not to detract from the importance of the issue, which right. I think is a very important one. It's about basic humanity. It's about basic freedoms and basic civil rights. And those should not be ignored. But you also can't ignore the context here, which is a bamboozle.
Well, and this brings up another interesting thing. Diane Lynn, as you know, with the, what are they called, the three bad girls now? The three
bad girls.
Oh. On the county commission, conspired, I think that's fair to say, to pass this ordinance which would allow gay marriage, mm-hmm. with the best of intentions.
Yeah.
And the result of that, though, was a stirring up the national campaign and the paranoia of these right-wingers.
Well, the anti-gay marriage ballot amendment had been drafted here long before they took that action at the county level. It was coming already.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, in that sense, you might say that the timing helped inflame the anti-gay marriage movement.
Yeah.
But those people had already, the plans were in the works. Roe Thorpe, when she came on the show, said as much.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. No, I think it's, but I think the whole, you know, I think what we ought to have is a constitutional amendment to outlaw marriage.
Yeah, just civil unions?
Nothing but civil unions. You know, that would be very fair. All right, we got some callers
we
out
do.
There.
231-8187 is the number to call. This is the Abe and Joe Show on KBOO 90.7. Janet, you're next.
Hi, good morning, you guys.
Hello, hey. Good morning.
I'm just sitting here at the bus stop with my son waiting for the bus to come, and we were wondering, does this mean that all of Bush followers are going to go up to heaven and they're going to finally leave us alone?
Yeah, I think that's how it works.
Wicked little ways? Yeah. And our health care and our environment and our gay marriages and just live our lives the way we want them. Are they all going to leave today? Is this the hope?
Well, apparently that day is coming soon. For about 2,000 years, they've been telling us it's coming soon.
Coming
so
soon.
Anytime now.
Anytime. Well, I hope so, because I'm just getting sick and tired of all their we just, well, we, as we were driving here, we saw one of those little Jesus fish.
Mm-hmm. Jesus fish, yes.
Those little Jesus fish, and it was eating a Darwin fish. And my kids were trying to figure out what that meant. Does that mean that science is bad? I mean, we can't even explain this craziness
yeah,
to our kids anymore.
That's exactly what it means.
It means reality yeah. is bad.
Reality is bad.
Yeah. Yeah. Objective reality is bad when it conflicts with dogmatic
arbitrary,
items of faith.
Arbitrary faith.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. No.
Well, this is just crazy. We can't even explain any of this from the war. You know, why don't we have health care, but it's okay to kill babies in Haditha? It's just, and you can't explain to your little kids what's going on today. There's got to be something so wrong. But I'm just hoping that all of their followers go up to heaven real soon and leave us here.
Well, I'm not sure I like that, because let's say that happens. Now, I assume they leave their clothes behind. And a lot of these people are not very attractive. And I'm not sure. I don't want to sound, you know, nasty or anything. But then I have some aesthetic concerns. Here I am, my children, my children's children, everyone out there watching while these people rise up naked to heaven.
Well, now, wouldn't that be worse than all the laws about, you know, holding and kissing in public and gay marriages? Wouldn't that be worse than all this public nudity? Do you think?
Maybe that'll be enough to stop the rapture. Maybe they'll be afraid of being seen naked, and it won't actually happen.
Well, what does actually happen? Maybe there's a rapturist out there listening to our show who could explain to us, since it's supposed to be a physical event, exactly
what... If he was listening to your show, his head would have imploded right now.
Hey, thank you for the call, Jim.
You guys are doing great. You guys have a good 666 day, okay?
Yeah,
okay.
You too.
Okay,
oh,
here
boy.
Comes the bus.
Bye-bye. Well, here comes the bus. Get another one on the bus.
The devil's bus. Ride the devil's bus. I'm sorry, another caller? Dean! Good morning. Hi, Dean.
How are you?
Hey,
You guys had touched on how the government's cutting veterans' benefits.
Yes.
And I just wondered, I'm 100% disabled combat vet from the first Gulf War.
I see.
You know, the reality is that we're losing a whole bunch of World War II vets.
Yes.
A whole bunch of Korean vets.
That's true.
And the money that those veterans were taking, it's not a one-for-one. It's one of the smallest militaries we've ever had.
In terms of manpower?
In terms of manpower, in terms of the numbers of people that are in Iraq right now,
mm-hmm.
and yes, that some are getting hurt, some are getting killed, you know, and it's my belief it may take 10 years for them to be compensated, but eventually they'll get compensated through the VA.
Mm-hmm.
But the numbers of veterans that are using the facilities has gone way down. So there needs to be some reduction in the numbers that are thrown at the VA. There's way too much bureaucracy within the VA, and you know you have large amounts of money going to the bureaucracy as opposed to the veterans themselves.
Well, I think I think you're making an interesting point, but what I understand happening from a lot of articles I've been reading, even in the popular press, people, even though the actual numbers of vets, as you point out, is pretty small, are not getting the services, given the modern technologies for recouping and so on, that they really should be getting. But I do agree with you that
that's always true.
Yeah.
It takes a long time to get into the system, to access the system. You would think, an amputee is an extreme case, but, you know, an amputee, it takes years for them to get back up on their feet,
sure.
Walking with a prosthetic that actually fits.
Mm-hmm.
That can be, it's not one of those overnight things. You'd like to, I mean, they can hand you a prosthetic, you know, right there in the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
But getting it to fit, getting the calluses to form around that amputation so that it's comfortable when you walk on it, takes a long time.
I can only imagine.
As far as PTSD and the services, they don't deal with mental health in this country. They don't deal with it on the civilian side. They don't deal with it on the military side.
Mm.
And once you get labeled PTSD or post-traumatic stress disorder,
mm-hmm.
They would just assume you go away and live a very quiet life because you're out of the... it takes years to come back from that trauma, whether it's killing civilians or whether it's, you know, watching your buddy die.
Sure.
Whatever whatever that trauma was,
mm-hmm.
and that also can take years to develop.
Well, you raise an interesting point. I've talked to veterans of World War II in Korea, and one of the things that was unacknowledged in our triumphalism, particularly after World War II, was the real pain, psychological, not to mention physical, of so many people coming back from that war. A relative in my family really doesn't want to talk about his war experiences. Even after all these years, he's not really comfortable with it. And I know a lot of people feel that way, not just because it's, you know, who wants to hear somebody else's old war stories, but because there's a lot of emotional pain associated with what they experienced. And our official line after World War II was, hey, you know, welcome home. You know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, I want to thank you very much for the call. I really appreciate it, man.
You guys do a good job. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah. You know, one of the trickiest things, I was thinking about this, one of the trickiest things is to make sure that we, as a nation, not so much honor as positively treat and care for those people who have experienced this, who are veterans. You know, a lot of people created this mythology after the Vietnam War that the vets were spit on and so on and so on. Turns out to be, if it took place, it was very, very, very rare. And it was done by crazies, you know, extreme crazies. But generally did not happen. But what did happen was that a hell of a lot of vets came back from Vietnam with a lot of real deep doubts and pain and sorrow and anger that was never really addressed. And I think that this is something that has to be addressed. But I would say that the thing that we all need to do right now, all of us, is make a resolution and make it law that the United States does not go to war unless the national interest is actually threatened. The only part of this current set of adventures that made any sense at all was going after Osama bin Laden. And then we turned that over in Tora Bora to the local warlords, who then obviously were paid off and didn't do the job.
Started planting opium again.
Exactly. So, and then, of course, the Bushies went back to their original plan of having a war in Iraq, which had nothing to do with any of it.
Yeah, you know, I'd even settled for not going to war unless Congress actually makes a declaration of war.
Yeah, a formal one, the real kind.
Which hasn't happened since December 8th of 1941.
That's absolutely true. That's absolutely true. In fact, you know, you look at the history of these disastrous wars, Korea, which I consider to be... If we had stopped at the 38th parallel, it would have been okay. But we essentially, under MacArthur and so on, and the China lobby tried to push our way north in this and convinced both the Soviets and the Chinese that we aimed to make a third world war, you know.
Yeah.
And then in order to settle the war, when they drove us back, the Chinese drove us back, we threatened to use nuclear weapons, which was never forgotten. I don't think people know that. Did you know that?
No, I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. The U.S. made it clear that if this couldn't be resolved... We had the weaponry, and of course, at that time, the Soviets had only a few nuclear weapons, and they couldn't reply in kind. Very serious moment in the Cold War that's been much ignored.
No, I did not know that.
That's very important. Very important. You know, of course, that we offered two nuclear weapons to the French at Dien Bien Phu in 1954.
Now that I didn't know either.
Yeah, it's all true.
Huh?
I do not make these things.
When did the French get the bomb? Probably
wasn't
long after.
Oh, they built their own bomb. That was later than that.
Right.
The French, of course, also. to stop Greenpeace objecting to their nuclear tests, blew up the Rainbow Warrior.
Yeah, that's true.
A lot of stuff happens. People tend to forget it. All right, 231-8187. We're open. Let's go out to Jeff. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, man, I'm back, and you guys are just right on, as always. That nuclear story out of Korea is something that no one should ever forget, especially as we enter an era where we're actually talking, our government is actually talking about using nuclear bunker busting bombs. But yeah. I come back.
Why are you back?
Well, I come back to give you two philosophical notions, especially the lovely lady that called and talked about the rapture and nudity. Oh, that'll be good, because there's two points. Number one is that the world peace could be brought about if everyone just took their clothes off and smoked a doobie.
You called us back to urge people to smoke dope and get naked?
I can't believe it. It has something to do with the musical Doobie Brothers or something like that. I heard that back in the 1970s.
Oh, no.
Anyway, my second point is this.
Yeah.
It is fundamentally important. There is a world of difference between faith and superstition. Faith, I believe in. I'll tell you why. I am an AIDS survivor.
Uh-huh.
And faith is what saw me through the early 1990s when I nearly died several times.
Yeah.
Now, of course, medicine has a lot to do with it, but faith and internal faith saw me through the period when the medicines weren't available. You see what I'm saying?
Sure.
And there's a world of difference between faith, both faith in yourself and in some greater thing,
and a world of superstition,
which is dangerous. You see what I'm saying?
Okay, uh-huh. But I have to tell you, remember, Jesus said faith, hope, and charity, and of these, the greatest is?
Jesus didn't say that.
Oh.
St. Paul wrote that crap.
All right, man.
He was bad.
No,
anyway,
that's
my point, is that superstition is ruling over faith, which is really, really something that's in line with where we as humans need to become, is if we gain faith, be men of faith, even little faith, like the mustard seed story, that's Jesus. He said even if you had teeny, teeny, tiny bit of faith, you could move the mountains. Remember that?
I will never forget that. Thanks for the call.
Thanks.
Thank you, Jeff. He's right about St. Paul.
Well, yeah, but I think, why didn't Jesus say faith, hope, and charity? The greatest of these is charity.
I don't know why he didn't say
charity. The point I was making is charity is more important than faith.
Oh, okay.
Or hope.
A lot of the, you know, the sexual shame in Christianity comes out of the writings of Paul.
Yes.
Well, and Paul homophobia,
also,
too.
Paul also, yeah, and Paul also shut the women up.
Right. And Paul also never knew Jesus. Paul had a conversion experience.
He knew Jesus.
Right, right. He had a conversion experience on the road to Damascus. And
here we are.
Yeah.
Talking about these books that, do you really, I mean, never mind.
231-8187 is the number to call. This is the Abe and Joe Show. If you're at Greg Palace address last night, please give us a call and let us know your impressions. I thought it was grand.
Oh,
and
it was
especially
okay.
What he said at the end. Because it's so easy to feel, impotent. Like, there's nothing we can do. Like, they're just going to steal the election again. Or, you know, they're just going to drop bombs on whomever they please and there's nothing we can do. But there is something we can do.
What's that?
Well, as he said last night, he was quoting Jesse Jackson. Every time we march, we win. Every time. And if they're going to steal if they're going to steal 5 million votes this next time, we got to bring 6 million to the polls. We got to make them steal it. That's what we do.
I'm stunned by your hopefulness.
Ah, don't be.
All right. I won't be. There's so many items here. I'm just overwhelmed. Public employees' free speech is under attack. In February of 2005, the Supreme Court granted certiorari. In this case, Lee raises legal issues whether job-related speech of public employees should have First Amendment protection under the matter of public concern test. California deputy district attorney was suspected that Deputy Sheriff had included false statements in a search warrant, and this DA told the supervisor's defense attorney in the case had his suspicions, and he claims he was demoted and transferred. So now you have this issue of whether or not you have free speech on the job, and this begins to relate to the universities. Do university professors have to have free speech? You know, the bad David Horowitz, the one who used to be a lefty in the 60s, but turned into a righty.
Yep, a neocon.
A neocon. The bad David Horowitz is encouraging these students and others to make lists, like McCarthyite lists, of the professors who advocate the bad ideas.
Those are that's not McCarthyite, that's Hitlerite.
Well, yeah, McCarthy, Hitler, you know.
Yeah.
It's only a short leap.
Yeah, yeah. Short leap and a little facial hair near there.
231-8187.
Dan, you're next.
Yeah, I want to go back into the Middle East and the U.S. policy there.
Okay.
Through the magic of radio.
I know, and I have something even better to reimagine the last 5 years if things have been done differently. And the thought I have is has to do with how much money has been spent since the invasion of Afghanistan. Now, that was the first event, right?
Mm-hmm.
Going after Osama bin Laden and the people involved with actually perpetrated the deed, right?
Right.
Now, what if after that invasion and tossing out the Taliban, which from what I've seen in documentaries were not all that well loved by a lot of people in Afghanistan because
not at all.
They were very oppressive and took away a lot of their rights, just their traditions. And
hey, the Taliban are a bunch of jerks, man.
Well, yeah, exactly. And so, you know, this whole thing about being greeted with flowers in Iraq, okay, that's debatable. But in Afghanistan, I think actually a lot of those people were relieved to get rid of the Taliban.
Yeah, a lot of women thought they were going to get their rights. Didn't happen.
All kinds of things. Okay, so that's off to we might say a good start, right?
Yeah, so
why, if you could take the dollars that have been spent on bombs, missiles, you know, military force, if you took those same dollars, which unfortunately I don't have the figure, do you happen to know how much has been spent in either Afghanistan or Iraq up to this point?
Well, I have a scientific term for it, a whole bunch of money.
Yeah, okay, we'll go with that. That's the figure
just
I have.
Just a whole
too.
Bunch
that's
of money.
A whole bunch. Okay, what
much
I
do, too much money.
What I do have is the population of Afghanistan.
Okay.
It's 28 million.
Mm-hmm.
That's not a lot. I don't know if other people like statistics, but that's not a lot of people by our standards.
Mm-hmm.
The gross national product per person, this is from the Britannic Almanac, just so you know my source, is $280 per person. the gross national product per person. Mm-hmm. In the United States, it's $35,000 per person gross national product. Okay, it gives you a little idea of where they are on the poverty scale. Look, now, for all the money that we spent on military force in the Middle East, what if that money from the beginning had been used to transform Afghanistan economically and socially, build schools, wipe out the opium fields, give them some other crop? They don't care what crop they're growing. They just want to make some money.
Give them
some food to grow, right? I'm sure there's something that grows in that climate.
Wheat actually grows in that climate.
You know, you can find plants for any climate. If poppies will grow there, some food will grow there, right?
Yeah.
So that solves the poppy problem, gives them a good... In other words, of course, it takes money to do these transformations, but I am absolutely sure that if we looked up the dollar figure, it would be more than enough to have totally transformed that country, and that would be a psychological example in the Middle East that actually could have achieved part of this goal of winning people over to, hey, look what's happened in Afghanistan. They've got freedom, more freedom now. They got rid of this Taliban thing, and now look what's happened. They're doing pretty well. Other countries in the region could observe the example of Afghanistan, but of course this was not done.
No, that was the intention in Iraq, obviously. Remember the beacon of democracy in the Middle East, the transformative domino effect that would take place after its alleged liberation? As I understand that, Afghanistan was supposedly part of that plan as well, but neither of those things ever came to pass.
Why didn't they follow through on it?
Well, because they never intended to do any of that.
Yeah, first of all, they never intended. Second of all, I think I have to disagree with you, because I think that one of the things that... that informs your argument is a set of assumptions about what Afghanistan's people might want for themselves. If you're really interested in self-determination for the Afghanis, and there are many different groups in Afghanistan, then part of what has to happen there is that the U.S. has to kind of step back from its role at this point. And that's something that the United States is absolutely unwilling to do. It is true that there is gross misuse of monies, and the military approach is particularly stupid. One distinction we always have to make, I think, is between the incredible stupidities of the way in which the Bush people have done their military activities in Afghanistan and Iraq, and the overall question of whether, in fact, any of that should have happened at all. Now, the one part of the Afghanistan thing that made some sense, well, two things. The first thing was, realistically, Osama bin Laden and his little crew of thugs should have been labeled international terrorist criminals. An international force led, if you wish, by the United States should have quickly gone down there, not made a deal with the warlords, but swooped in, grabbed whoever they could, put them on trial internationally, or if you couldn't pull that off, kill them. That's okay. That should have happened right away. It didn't. That was bungled. That's number one. Number two... overthrowing the Taliban, problematic issue, was a good idea in one sense, but opened up a disastrous set of problems in another sense. In Iraq, there's absolutely no excuse whatsoever in terms of the terrorist issue.
Well, why? I don't understand why you question whether the Afghanis would have liked us to have dug wells and started farms and schools. What would their? You think they would have objected to that?
I
don't understand your point.
No, I think that Afghanistan was, prior to the Taliban, from the conversations I've had with people who've been there, a fairly self-sufficient, albeit poor nation.
$280 per person?
Well, that, you know, that's...
No, it's a very poor country, Joe.
That's true. But
I've seen documentaries. I've seen films of it. That's...
Well, you've got to also understand that it was a multi-ethnic community, that it had, at one point, very lush fields. They had a lot of opium growing, a lot of marijuana growing. Yeah, they were engaged in the drug trade. There's a whole bunch of that that's traditional and existed for a long, long time. My point is that, indeed, if it could have been a legitimate government in Afghanistan, and if it could have gotten foreign aid, that would have been one thing. the process that we engaged in, which was to rebuild a government along the lines of a traditional American/European style of government, maybe the assumptions in that may be unwarranted, may be wrong. And I don't know that there's a way, I don't know if there's a way to solve the problem by the methods that you're suggesting. Yes, if we had, for example, used something like a volunteer corps of humanitarians, yes, if we'd used Doctors Without Borders, yes, if we'd done a number of those things, as well as knocking the Taliban out, something different might have happened. But it still remains extremely problematic. And we also need to know that, you know, that we haven't solved anything in Afghanistan at this point.
Well, I don't know why they didn't follow that course, but part of my point is the dollars. I mean, you're questioning whether it's possible, but I figured this out many years ago, and mm-hmm. I don't have any figures in front of me now, but the sheer amount of dollars that the military approach takes is so massive. It's,
oh, no, we agree. I mean, look, we agree about that.
I mean, the things you could do with that money, Joe, mm-hmm. are mine. I mean, economically, if they were put toward the kind of efforts I'm talking, you know, building the economy up and the
infrastructure,
you know, infrastructure and all that, roads, well, water, roads, basics of life. But once you have those basics of life, then they can take it from there.
I don't think we disagree on that.
The power of that money. That's why we need the figure, but I know for a fact it is so huge, the amount that's spent on one rock, you know, one guided rocket, you know, one of these smart bomb type things. I mean, it's a fortune just for one rocket. What you can do for people in terms of their actual physical needs with the cost of one rocket.
You're right. And
it's mind-boggling.
Okay, and I want us to continue on with another topic, but you are right. You do have a good point, but I want to get as many callers in today as possible. And so I want to remind people it's 231-8187. And Paul, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
I have kind of along the same lines as the amount of taxes we pay. We should have the best quality of national health care. Our schools should be the top notch for the amount of money we pay in taxes.
Oh, I agree.
And I think last April 15th, when we paid our taxes, that's basically like a little footnote on the bottom of a check, whereas, right, paid in full. That's pretty much.
Hello?
Agreeing with what they're spending the money on.
Well, look, there's no question that since this administration has taken over, in fact, I would argue that we tend to demonize the Bushies because they're so gross about everything and so awful and have taken over in the interest of such a small a group of opportunistic criminals and wealthy people.
Right.
We tend to want to demonize them, but let's not forget that the Democratic Party itself, in the previous 8 years, abandoned the principles of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, abandoned the ideas of social democracy, and essentially turned toward the center, or the right, if you will, and in that process moved away from the very things, the very values that I suspect you and I share about where our tax dollars should go. And this is a process that has gone on for a long, long time. And it even predates that. So one of the things that needs to be done, and one of the things that American people need to understand, is they need to look at some of the European democracies, which are capitalists, by the way, and understand what kinds of possibilities there could exist. Another thing that needs to be understood is the advantage of progressive as opposed to regressive taxation. Right now, all the talk is regressive tax-based. For example, there's talk of a national consumption tax, as they call it, which is basically a sales tax. They do have those in Europe, by the way, and they call them value-added taxes. All of those essentially hurt ordinary people. The current tax structure in the U.S. has been revised in such a manner that the rich pay next to nothing compared to what they could be paying or should be paying.
Oh, they still pay too much.
Right. And they hate that. And the rest of us have more and more of the burden of government. Meanwhile, systematically, this administration, uniquely, I think, is deliberately creating a situation where, number one, all the services offered by the government require fees and are poorly executed, so we all hate government even more and therefore want even fewer taxes. And number two, we'll have such enormous debt on our children that we'll never be able to get universal health care. We'll never be able to get any of the things that we ought to be able to get for the money that we are investing in our government.
Oh, exactly. We're leaving an inheritance of such a debt to our kids and grandkids.
Well, you and I aren't doing that. The Bush administration's doing that. Let's be clear.
I realize that, but because we're pretty much we have the ability as a nation to turn that around by the way we vote and by the way I'm not saying the Democrats are any better.
Could be better. I mean, obviously. One of the things that has to happen is at the local levels and at the congressional level, which is also local, there have to be really good candidates being put up. I was very disappointed by Obama, for example. I thought, hey, this is a guy who has some liberal politics, but he's totally rolled over for the kind of Clintonite thinking.
Milquetoast centrist.
Yeah, milquetoast centrist.
Invertebrate.
Thought. And, you know, and Hillary Clinton, the coward.
Same
in
way.
The coward in a yellow suit, you know. I mean, there's enough of this stuff. We have to, all of us, we have to level. But on the other hand, we've got people. I want to praise a couple of people right here. I think Ron Wyden, though a couple of issues I disagree with him on, has done a wonderful job. He really has struggled hard. And I think Earl Blumenauer and lots of other of our congresspeople in Oregon have done excellent work and have fought long and hard for the kinds of things that I think you and I would share.
I agree, but I wonder how much stiff-arming the people that really want to accomplish something, once they get involved in the whole system, I think they're strong-armed into complying. And if they don't comply,
mm-hmm.
then they'll just run into roadblocks.
Well,
throughout their whole political career.
Part of the problem is that the quid pro quos of our system, without a strong governmental plan or direction, a liberal or left direction, particularly social democratic direction, tends to lead us into the kind of quagmires we're in or have been in for a lot of years now. It's not just, but the point I wanted to make is it's not just the horrors of this particularly proto-fascist administration. It's a whole set of precedents that have set this situation up, and it's going to take a lot of work to undo it. Can it be undone? You bet. But it's going to require everyone out there, each of us, to take on the responsibility of contacting, I would say, 10, 20 people regularly and building up consciousness and concern and commitment to changing this. What most people do in their horror and disgust is to turn away. And in America, it has long been a tradition now to treat politics as the least interesting of sports. I mean, in American terms, it's below the World Cup.
Oh, stop that.
Yeah, I agree. But to serve our in a political position position in our country, it should be a privilege, not a means by which to benefit yourself down the road.
Oh, I think that's how privilege is interpreted. Or you ascend to elected office and then you get privileges.
I suppose.
Yeah. Okay, well, listen. Thank you for the call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Well, you can't escape tax policy as sort of the meta argument for everything that's going on today. I know we've emphasized this many, many times on this show, but the historically unprecedented flowering of the intellectual middle class in this country happened when taxes on the wealthiest Americans were about three times as high as they are today.
It also happened when huge numbers of working class people, veterans, got college education.
Yes, they did. How was that funded? By these self-same high wartime taxes.
No, you're absolutely right. In fact, the best times in American history, really, were the times with high taxes on the wealthiest. And by the way, the greatest economic growth took place in those times.
This is true. Even if you look at the 1990s, which in terms of the tax rate paid by the rich was a pale shadow of the post-war era, still, when Bill Clinton raised marginal tax rates on the richest Americans, the economy prospered.
And the rich got richer.
See, that's what's left out of this debate. When you hear rich people and Republicans complaining about taxes, they fail to mention that during that entire post-war period, a whole lot of people got a whole lot more wealthy than they were. And a whole lot of them were formerly members of the working poor. But the aristocracy prospered right along with them. That's a little fact that's often omitted from anti-tax diatribes.
You know, in fact, I would urge people out there within the sound of our voices to call Senator Gordon Smith and tell him not to repeal the estate tax or even to reduce the estate tax. And his phone numbers, I'm going to give you the phone numbers right now. Gordon Smith, he's our senator, believe it or not. He's the man who owns the green pea factory.
Flavor pack.
All them peas at the pea mine. Anyway, contact Gordon Smith. Tell him, hey, we don't want the estate tax repealed. And to call him, you call him in Washington, D.C. at 202-224-3753. That's 202-224-3753. Or if you want to call his local office here in Portland, no reason not to do that, 503-326-3386. That's 503-326-3386.
Here's what Paul Krugman has to say about those estate tax. In the interest of stiffening those spines, and he's talking about Democrats who strike devil's bargains with the Republicans all the time and basically give them everything they want.
Those are those 666 Democrats.
And also he's talking about moderate Republicans who consistently cave into their party's right wing.
Yeah.
Here's what Krugman says. In the interest of stiffening those spines, let me remind senators that this isn't just a fiscal issue, it's also a moral issue. Congress has already declared that the budget deficit is serious enough to warrant depriving children of health care. How can it now say that it's worth enlarging the deficit to give Paris Hilton a tax break?
Well, that's why you brought up Paris Hilton.
I did.
I thought you were obsessed with her strange video.
No, I think she's kind of ugly, actually.
Okay.
Too skinny. But Krugman's right. This is a moral issue. I mean, early on in the history of this country, the existence and the perpetuation of a hereditary aristocracy was viewed as a socially, that was not a good idea, socially. We acted to get rid of hereditary aristocracies.
Yeah, but to be fair, very early on you began to see the creation of it.
You know, and you're not ever going to completely get rid of wealthy families who hand down their wealth to their descendants, and that's human nature, and you're never going to get rid of that. But the estate tax was a leveler, a device that helped smooth out those social inequities, and it was the conventional wisdom was that it was worth it on a whole bunch of levels. That it was better for our society.
You know, look, it doesn't take that much money.
No.
And besides which, there's all these lawyers who figure out ways around it.
Right. But there's one question you can't ask in a capitalist society like that, and that is, how much is enough?
There's can't never ask enough.
Right. You can't ask that question.
This is Satan speaking. There's never enough.
All right. We got to take care of some biz here. Coming up this morning on KBOO at 9 on Between the Covers, host Ed Goldberg speaks with Elizabeth Rosner, author of Blue Nude, the story of an artist and his model, and the moral and political implications of their relationship. At 9:30, it's Black Book Talk with a focus on books by black authors. At 10, Ariel Gore interviews Dexter Flowers about her spoken mic, which is emerging as the hot, queer, and queer-friendly spoken word venue in town, and her new zine release party for the show Under the Sea. At 10:30 on Stage and Studio, the topic star Domalee Io's new show, Yarn, an Artist Repertory Theater's production of Theater District. And at 11, it's Democracy Now!
Yay!
Stories include anti-war candidates prepare to challenge Democrats in upcoming midterm elections and Noam Chomsky on Latin American politics, all coming up today on KBOO 90.7, your listener-supported
radio
station.
Man, I love Democracy Now.
I do.
It's the greatest show.
I do. There are a lot of you at Greg Palast thing last night. Hundreds of you. I can't believe none of you called.
Well, they're just so happy.
Yeah, I know. Call. 231-8187.
Lewis.
Good morning.
Joe, aside from being blonde, tall, handsome, blue-eyed as a young tab hunter.
Yeah, tan but not too tan.
Oh, well, yeah.
This is America, after all.
You remember who Tab Hunter was?
Oh, I remember Tab Hunter.
Yeah. Well,
Who could forget Tab Hunter?
You're also an academician, right? In the.
Excuse me, I'm a what?
You know, you're in the discipline of political science.
No, actually not. Sociology and history, but that's
okay. Oh, sociology and history. Oh, yeah, okay. Well, I would welcome you holding forth on why there was such a reluctance among the founding fathers for having standing armies. Stemming, of course, from their understanding of what had happened in history and how militarism tended to become politicized, or that is, the military, a standing army, tended to take sides with one political element against others and force, to bring about the course of the politics taking a particular direction.
Right.
You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, well, I don't know that I need to hold forth. I think you've said it. Armies in the hands of whomever are a very powerful force, and they are, especially today with the technology that armies have, they're pretty frightening. They're pretty terrifying.
Well,
but what's interesting, I do want to answer.
The question follows. Are we now a warrior cult? I've asked this question to you before.
Has America
become a warrior cult where, in our having been militarized, where performance in the military has come to be viewed as a virtue in and of itself? The duty oath of anyone joining the military is firstwise to protect the Constitution.
Right.
There's that, and then also, if we had universal health care, would there be the necessity of a Veterans Administration?
Well, that's a good point. In fact, I want to take off on that point. If we had a decent system of free public education based on ability, clear through university education all the way up to PhDs and so on, if we had a decent universal health care system, if we had decent child care, if we had a whole host of these social democratic reforms, none of which require the abolition of capitalism, by the way, if we had them, we would have a great deal of problem filling the ranks of the armed forces of the United States. The reason why we have the army we do today is because there's so many young people who can't find meaningful work, who can't get a decent education, who can't get good health care, and the armed forces stands ready to offer them that.
Well, that applies as well to the people who filled the ranks of the Nazi army.
Yes.
Yeah, but of course...
Almost all armies, by the way, prior to drafts, are exactly that. Young men, now young men and women, looking for something to do and a way to earn a living and something meaningful.
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 Yes. Well, are we going to label all of these returning vets who participated at Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo? Are we going to have them wear ankle bracelets like pedophiles coming into the neighborhood?
Well,
these are dangerous people.
Well, first of all, let's be clear about this. We, you and I, have no idea how many of the soldiers in the armed forces in this war or set of wars are, in fact, war criminals. And we don't know which ones are or are not. This is going to be a problem. But I don't want to label, and I want to be clear about this.
Why not?
Well, because I think it's a really dangerous thing to label every single member of the military as a war criminal.
I didn't, but do we not deserve to know who are the criminals?
Well, ideally we do, and it's an issue that goes on and on and on. The question of who, in fact, was responsible for the Nazi atrocities is still debated all over the academic world.
Mm-hmm. And to a certain extent, we do know the names of... at least the people in the cells and in the hallways at Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo who committed some of these crimes. There have been a number of convictions, and these people are now serving terms in Fort Leavenworth. But in my opinion, while these people did perpetrate these acts and do deserve to go to jail, the true criminals in this case are the architects of the policy and the enablers of this behavior, which I believe start with Secretary of Defense Don Rumsfeld, Vice President Dick Cheney, former Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz, and even the President of the United States. If those people had not given the green light to what happened at Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo, it would never have happened.
But we all bear the responsibility because it is a government of the people.
Agreed.
Agreed. I mean, I keep hearing this pandering, really, to a kind of a militarized mentality that everybody who is simply a enlisted person in the military bears no responsibility for this.
Every individual,
chaos.
Every human being bears responsibility for their behavior, regardless of the training or whatever happens to them. Ultimately, each of us has to be responsible for our own behavior. But that doesn't mean that there isn't this factor that Abe just talked about.
But when they come back, they're all going to be treated differentially from you and me as civilians. They're going to have benefits. Why should there be benefits for veterans different from benefits for the general population?
Well, because the simple reason that a contract was signed, man.
The contract is with the Constitution. That's what citizenship
No, the contract
means.
Was a contract that each
person who serves in the volunteer armed forces signs. It guarantees them certain things in exchange for their service.
That's why we have a warrior cult in this country. That is exactly what
you're... We have a warrior cult for a variety of reasons. This is a symptom that you're mistaking for a cause. I don't want to spend a long time on this, but the fact of the matter is we have had a cult of militarism in this society from our very inception. It has waxed, it has waned, it has persisted, both for good and bad reasons, for a long, long time.
And in Western culture and Eastern culture and every other culture.
Right. When I take it upon myself to commit an act of civil disobedience or to participate in a peace march, that's a decision I made.
Right.
If I join the military, it's a decision I've made.
Yes.
It's the responsibility, the culpability is upon me one way or another.
We don't disagree with you. All I said earlier was that there is a contract involved. Now, if you're asking for the ultimate moral questions involved...
No, I'm talking about citizenship. I'm talking about what is one's expectation from one's actions.
Okay, one of the big questions and one of the big issues is, what are we teaching our young people? If you're a young man or a young woman, you get dolls as a kid. Now, boy dolls are called action figures. Action figures learn to do bad things to other action figures. If you play video games, you learn to do robberies, rapes, murders.
Oh, hogwash.
Mayhem.
Hogwash.
Hogwash?
Yeah, continue. But hogwash.
Oh, well, hogwash. Anyway, I'm going to let you go. I want to give some others an opportunity while we argue about hogwash.
Well, on Memorial Day... Is it the VA, not the VA, the American Legion Veterans of Foreign Wars who march and parade under the flag, or is it people who participated in peace actions?
Well,
The point is we have a militarism. Goodbye.
Bye.
What are you hogwash?
What are you hogging?
One comment about what he said.
Why are you washing my hog?
I'll get to the pigs in just a minute.
Okay.
Yes, we tend to venerate... warriors and military culture, along with every other culture in history. We do so largely these days, I think, because it's a convenient trope for those on the right who support the meta reasons for our foreign adventurism right now. So you remember how in the lead-up to war, a Democrat who dared to raise their voice in opposition had to preface every statement with, "Of course I support the troops," or "Absolutely I support the troops," because we hold up this ideal of the selfless citizen soldier who bravely does his or her duty without question and follows orders and puts their body in harm's way, allegedly for the values that we hold dear. We put that ideal up on a pedestal. But it's very convenient politically to equate opposition with whatever a military effort is going on, to equate that opposition with a disdain for those selfsame sacrificing veterans, which of course is hogwash.
Ah, there's the hogwash.
Right. So to that extent, we have a military cult, but largely because it's politically convenient for conservatives in this country. Now, when you play a video game that involves...
There's the hogwash.
Here's the hogwash. You play a video game that involves shooting or involves the commission of crime, it doesn't teach you to do these things. There's a clear demarcation between what's going on the screen and what's going on in real life. I mean, I play some video games with my son, and at the end of the day, I'm not worried at all that he's going to go out and shoot somebody because he knows what's going on
screen.
Didn't
I see him at the 7-Eleven with that big .45?
Yeah, that was him. He knows that what's going on the screen is something completely distinct from reality.
But that's your son. That's not every son. I'm serious about this. I think that we have a culture of violence which is very much a part of our media, which includes video games. And I think it does, and I think there are even studies to support this, which does
you
encourage...
You think there are studies to support
Oh,
this.
I know there are studies. Okay. I know there are studies. Let's make a Talmudic distinction. I know there are studies that show that right after watching a bunch of violent stuff, kids have more violent ideation and behavior. Now, how long that lasts, how many times is significant, I don't know.
I think that that video games are no more responsible for youth violence than bad words on record albums are responsible for anything. I mean, you sound like Tipper Gore here.
Excuse me.
You sound like Tipper
Excuse
Gore.
Excuse me. Tipper Gore. Okay, we're going to have to agree to disagree on this one.
Yeah, I think so.
Because we neither of us got a lot of stats in front of us, do we?
I mean, the same argument can be put forward. I've heard the same argument that you're making made about, violent cartoons.
Well,
I don't think any kid sits down and watches a violent cartoon and then turns away from the TV and thinks he's still in the cartoon.
Do you think that the problem solving represented by the Saturday morning cartoons, which always involves authority and violence, is a good way of teaching problem solving to children?
I think that Saturday morning cartoons are more about purchasing products after a 30-minute
episode. I'm not disputing that role. I'm just making a point. I'm saying that they are educational. Everything a child sees is part of their education.
Sure.
And if you teach them that the solution to problems is the use of authority and violence as opposed to reason and argument and presentation of ideas and so on, then you're teaching them not good things.
Now, I would dispute that the those messages are absent from a lot of kids' cartoons. My son, a few years ago, when the Pokemon craze was huge, he liked to watch the Pokemon cartoon. And every Pokemon episode usually would end with, some resolution of a dispute, somebody saying, hey, you know, I'm sorry, and I always had too much wrapped up with defeating you. And, it's not all about using authority to solve problems.
You're not watching enough Saturday morning cartoons.
Yeah, maybe I'm not. But I don't think they're nearly the plague that you're making them out to be. But anyway.
All right. 231-8187. Ken, you're on the air.
Well, good morning, Joe and Abe.
Hey, good morning.
Appreciate the show. I was at Greg Palace last night, and it's great to see so many people out there.
It was.
And I agree with what you've been saying over the months or years I've been listening about the friendly fascism.
Yeah.
And I'm just kind of supposing, though, like, say what Greg Palace prophesied, if they steal 3 million, we'll get 5 million.
Yeah.
Okay, but as a friendly fascist, if they face that kind of defeat, when might they become less friendly fascists? When might they show that ugly face, the Kristallnacht or whatever?
It so happens that I've been thinking about this.
Great minds think alike.
Well, what I think the big wild card here between now and the presidential elections 2008 is, I think, the inevitable probability of a second major terrorist attack.
Uh-huh.
And if that happens, that may be the time when the mask finally falls away.
So, like, we'll have a super Patriot Act, something like that?
Super Patriot
Martial
Act.
Law.
Or
Martial
even,
law.
And this
Martial
is
law.
The thing, yeah. This is the thing that keeps me up at night. You know, let's fast forward here to, say, September or October of 08. There's a big terrorist attack. The Golden Gate Bridge is blown up or something like that.
Uh-huh.
I don't think it's outside the bounds of possibility for these guys to say, well, we're just going to postpone the election until things calm down.
Yeah, I thought that as well.
Well, actually, Richard Nixon had a study done to see whether he could postpone an election. That's really true.
I see these guys aren't even original, are they?
No, but the conclusion apparently, either the study never was actually done, or the conclusion clearly was, nope. But I don't think it's impossible, particularly since I now view most of the electorate as so disillusioned and disinterested, and I got lots of stats that support it. The majority of people who could vote in American elections actually don't.
Oh, understood.
Yeah.
On that same note, now I don't know if you might know whether this is true or not. This goes back to my teenage years reading the articles in Playboy magazine. But they talked about legislation that was
there articles in Playboy magazine?
There were. And I even discovered them at that young age, surprisingly.
Well, I only bought it for the pictures.
Well, yeah, but you get tired. You know, your arm gets tired after a while.
Anyway, I'm sorry I encouraged that. I really am sorry I encouraged that.
There was about the Internal Security Act. Does that ring a bell?
Uh-huh.
And does that still exist? Is that still on the books?
Oh, the Subversive Activities Control Board and all that stuff?
Well, the idea in this article was, like I say, and I don't know how well-sourced it was or anything else, was that there existed, like, mothballed concentration camps, basically, that if there was enough civil unrest, they could just, round people up and put them in these camps.
Specifically, if there was enough African-American civil unrest, they could round them up and put them in
camps. Here's two or three things I do know about that. The Supreme Court ruled eventually, and I can't remember the dates, but late 60s, early 70s, that the Subversive Activities Control Board itself, which was to look into communists, and the process of registering people as in order of one categories 1, 2, and so on,
right,
to go to the camps, all of that was illegal.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so that was the McCarran-Walters Act and the Smith Act and so on. All that stuff was essentially made by the courts unconstitutional.
As I say, this was specifically called the Internal Securities Act.
Yeah. That's I can't remember. I think it's the Walters McCarran Act.
I see.
But anyway, and I'm not sure which law that is, so I want to be careful there. But I know it's one of those that I mentioned, and you're right, that did exist. But the courts said it was unconstitutional. Now, does that mean it can't happen? It supposedly means that those concentration camps were, which most of them, by the way, were used during World War II as internment camps for Japanese Americans.
Right.
Those camps supposedly have either been disappeared or mothballed. Mm-hmm. Do they exist or not? Depends on how paranoid you are or what you can find out. That's part of the problem. But also, this is the Supreme Court that's been put together by these fascists.
Right.
So who knows what they might decide to do? And that is a real problem. That's one major issue. It is also the case that a lot of Americans don't seem to hold in high regard their First Ten Amendment rights. And that is a real problem.
Well,
without a vigilant, aware, reasonably educated, and concerned citizenry, you got a serious problem. And many, many people are so turned off and so cynical and so self-interested at this point historically that represents a real, real problem. Now, how serious would this all be in the case of a real national emergency or even one, and those conspiracists out there are welcome to this one, created by these people? I don't know. It is troubling. It is something to be awake at night about. But I think that what one has to do to be a good citizen and existentially speaking is to resist the tyranny at every level. I believe that if all of us, even this small audience, spent one day a week, that is an eight-hour period, in active political engagement to support those things they believe in, things would be a hell of a lot better. And I believe most of us don't do that. So that's just something to think about.
Right. One quick thing, going back to kind of the original idea that if they decided to drop the mask, is there a point at which the majority of Americans, the rank and file, who may not be paying attention now, might resist them?
Well, we don't know. We do know from history in other countries that people are remarkably unable to recognize that moment, or at least unwilling to act when they do recognize that moment.
The
United States has a bit of a different tradition. Germany, for example, hadn't been a democracy for very long compared to the United States. But, it's hard to say. If you and I are involved, probably we would be resistant. But many people, most people, probably are more interested in having their daily bread and having their house and having their comforts. When is the point when people begin, for example, to recognize the need for organizing themselves into labor unions again and fighting for their rights there?
Perhaps when they don't have enough to eat.
Maybe it takes that far. But, Russia was maintained as a totalitarian state long before the communists came along.
Yeah.
And people suffered there for a huge amount of time.
Yeah, because like I say, with the Romans, it was bread and circuses, but I think the Americans were getting, a lot of people are getting pretty short on the bread.
Well, that's an interesting point. I don't know the answer, and I do know this. It's time for if the Democrats want to be the party, party of loyal opposition, if they want to really offer an alternative, they're going to have to move not to the center, but to the left. They're going to have to become a social democratic party. They're going to have to come out against these absurd wars. They're going to have to change a lot of their policies. And the candidates they've thrown forward so far, I don't trust at all.
Yeah, well, thanks so much for the work you're doing,
guys. Yeah, thanks
guys.
For the call.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, Caesar's comment on bread and circuses is one of the wisest things ever said, and it still holds true today. Only we have more bread and better circuses now.
Well, yeah, and we are perfectly willing to watch our poor rot. 231-8187. You're listening to Abe and Joe. This is KBOO, 90.7 on your FM dial. Coming up soon, some incredible programming after us. And, of course, Democracy Now! At 11. But let's go out to Mike. Hi, Mike.
Hey, can you hear me?
Yes, I do.
Good morning.
Yeah, I was wanted to talk about this Greg Palast guy.
Uh-huh.
No, I didn't attend, but...
You didn't attend?
No.
Mike, of all people, you should have attended.
Well, I was busy, but, I do have some criticisms, though.
Mm-hmm. Now, wait, you're going to criticize a guy you didn't hear?
Yes.
Okay.
Because yesterday I listened on the radio, and he never got into anything of any, he never got into meat and potatoes of anything. And to me, I think that was a travesty. Because there's a lot of people that was listening that he should have took it time to get into some details about what's going on out here, and he didn't do that.
Well, now, if you had gone last night, you would have heard him discuss specifically an issue of great concern to you, as I recall your various conversations with us, that is the disenfranchisement systematically of African-American voters.
In the last two elections, he went into great detail on it.
Well, that's the reason I'm criticizing, because a lot of people couldn't make it for various reasons, and to me, he sounded more like these real estate guys that are telling you, I can show you how to get rich, but, hey, you got to buy it.
Well, he was definitely, you're right in this sense, Mike. He was definitely hustling an audience for his performance that night. And I don't fault him for that, because it's hard to get people like yourself, up and out and at a meeting. It's hard to do that, particularly when, and this is not about you, it's about people in general, particularly when there are so many other demands on our lives and opportunities for entertainment.
Right, and see, there are certain things out here that should not have a commercial value to it, and one of them is freedom. You know, and I understand that right now in America, freedom is an illusion, and people need to understand that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm tired of hearing people talking about, well, this is a democratic democracy don't exist here, folks. It's an illusion. But this guy, you know, people like him shouldn't try to commercialize how to go about changing.
He ain't getting rich. He's just earning a living. I mean, be real here. His lifestyle is lower middle class at best.
Okay, you know, but anyway, that's one thing. You know, when you guys talk about the players in this thing,
mm-hmm.
one of the players that is hardly ever talked about is the financiers. Your friend talk about the transnational corporations, but you know, they got to have backers because mm-hmm. they ain't using their own money.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because Paul Wolfowitz, one of the architects of this neoconservative debacle that's going on, is now head of the World Bank.
Thank you.
Hey, go ahead.
No, go ahead. And I'm just saying that we need to, you know, we need to talk about them as well as the industrialists. You also need to talk about, I noticed that when there's atrocities going on in this war, mm-hmm. it never goes any higher than Rumsfeld.
Now, we just talked about that just a minute ago. Abe here was talking about how the real responsibility does lie at that level. You want to take it beyond them to what? To the industrialists?
I want to take it beyond that to the president.
Well, yeah, we're with you there.
Okay.
Pallister last night mentioned the financiers and their role in this. He described the Iraq War as not a blood for oil mission, but as a blood for petrodollars mission. In other words, we buy a lot of oil from Saudi Arabia. We go to war and permanently station troops in the region. And in exchange, the royal family in Saudi Arabia keeps buying American treasury bills and keeps financing George Bush's $7 trillion and counting spending spree. He made that connection, which I think is a very important one that not a lot of people are making.
Okay, well, you know, I missed that. And if you guys could talk on that more, and not this show, next show. I really appreciate it.
All right, gotcha. Man. We will.
Hey, thanks for listening, Mike. I always like your calls, man.
Take care. Take a deep breath.
Yeah. Mike's a challenging caller, man. He keeps us on our toes.
We started the show with 666.
Yes, we did.
And your weird, what was that? Iron Maiden.
Iron Maiden.
Ooh, heavy metal, dude. And then we had this, I did a little stroke for ourselves about this. This letter to the editor in, amazingly, the Hood River News from Hood River, Oregon, mm-hmm. praising you and me, dude.
Who'd have thunk it?
Who would have thunk it? For us being lefties.
Hey, the check's in the mail. Thanks for writing the letter.
Well, we don't know hardly any checks. I don't speak Czech. What are you talking?
Speaking of the Czechs,
yes.
They play the Americans on Monday in our first World Cup match.
You wanted to talk about the World Cup.
I'm taking the day off of work to watch the match.
Do you think the Americans could beat the Czechs?
It's going to be tough. Czechs are really good.
Since we have a little, I need to understand something just real quickly. Aren't World Cup teams made up of professional players who come back to the country mm-hmm. that essentially yeah. is their origin nation?
Yes.
So it's like pro ball.
Yeah. Yeah, all these guys play for club teams.
So it's just
the best in Europe.
It's got nothing to do with nothing.
Oh, no. You clearly don't understand. You're just going to have to watch and then learn. That's all. The Cup starts on Friday. First match is Friday, and it goes for about a month.
My partner was in Germany when Germany won that World Cup a while back.
Uh-huh.
And what she saw was a rise of all these imperial, you know, the Nazi flags are illegal. So they had all these imperial black, white, and red flags suddenly showing up. People marching, singing Deutschland, Deutschland.
Yep.
Scary nationalism.
Well, yeah, there is a great deal of nationalism tied up in this, a great deal of pride, and yes, often a great deal of xenophobia. But it's
hooliganism.
Sure, but it's a hell of a lot more healthy to have that expressed in terms of soccer fandom than it is on the battlefield, in my opinion.
And of course, soccer is really just what football really is.
Right. And in many ways, and I'm getting a little grandiose here, but in many ways,
little?
Soccer between nations, and to a lesser extent between, you know, clubs in various cities, you know, has become a symbolic representation of that sort of tribal rivalry.
Well, I don't, in that sense, it's healthy. I would go further. I think that the way wars should be fought, if we have to have wars, is the top 10 leaders of the economy and the top 10 leaders of the government, of the country that is, of each country that want to fight, should be put on a muddy field naked, and it's to the death.
What's with you and nudity today?
Well, I just like the exposure.
Oh, okay.
Besides, it's 666 day.
Yes, it is.
All right, 2318187. Do we have time for more?
We have time for another caller or two if we make it.
Janet, guess. Janet, real quick, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm back again. Jeff came.
Whoa.
I'm not naked. I'm not smoking a doobie, but I did want to round a few things up here.
But call us back when you are.
No, ignore him. Ignore him. He's just a sexist idiot.
Yeah, it's that day. It's just that hedonism in all of us. The thing that I wanted to talk about was, you've talked about so much while I've been on waiting, but the thing that, reason why we're going and we're spending so much money killing people is that war is profitable. Peace is priceless, and peace is a beautiful thing, but people make a lot more money off of war. And there was a wonderful lyric, getting my kids into the Phil Oaks and Woody Guthrie, because I'm just now learning about them. And we were reading a lyric by Woody Guthrie talking about the warships, and it says, you know, turn those warships around and bring back food and clothing and water. That's how you get rid of terrorism. That's how you get rid of the Taliban. That's how we're going to get rid of the Bush regime, if we bring everybody into the peace movement. And one of the things that was really scary for me when I started doing the marches and the protests is I thought really it was going to consume my life. And really, when you get down to it, our lives are already consumed by politics.
Hey, we've run out of time, and I really appreciate your call.
Oh, no. Okay, well, I'll get undressed now. I'll talk to you later. You guys have a wonderful day, okay?
All right, stay tuned, folks, and don't forget Amy Goodman at 11 o'clock.
Ken, thanks for tuning in.
This program is made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Cotton Cloud Futons, a locally owned business featuring futons and mattresses, frames, covers, furnishings, and accessories which can be made with organic and recycled materials. Cotton Cloud is located at 701 Northeast Broadway in Portland. Information at 503-335-0758 or cottoncloudfutons.com.
Good morning. You're tuned to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. Welcome to the Tuesday Radio Zine. Coming up first on Between the Covers, host Ed Goldberg speaks with Elizabeth Rossner, author of Blue Nude, the story of an artist and his model and the moral and political implications of their relationship. At 9:30, it's Black Book Talk with a focus on books by Black authors. At 10, Ariel Gore interviews Dexter Flowers about her spoken mic, which is emerging as the hot, queer, and queer-friendly spoken word venue in town, and her new zine release party for the show, Under the Sea. At 10:30, on stage and studio, the topics are Damali Ayo's new show, Yarn, an Artist Repertory Theater's production of Theater District. And at 11, it's Democracy Now! Stories include anti-war candidates prepare to challenge Democrats in upcoming midterm elections and Noam Chomsky on Latin American politics. Now let's go to Between the Covers.